Good morning, everybody. It's so nice to see you all. And my name is Sue Zappel, if for anybody who I haven't met before, and welcome to our Sunday Sangha. So everyone knows that we'll sit for 25 or 30 minutes, and then we'll get a chance to say hello to everybody and check in just briefly. Then I'll give a Dharma talk. We're spending the whole year on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And this month of June is the second fold of the Eightfold Path, which is right intention. So I'll give a talk on that, and then we'll have a chance to chat with each other about it. And I'm going to start our meditation this morning with this amazing poem by Margaret Atwood. I'll read it at the beginning and at the end. It's called The Moment. The moment when, after many years of hard work and long voyage, you stand in the center of your room, house, half acre, square mile, island, country, knowing at last how you got there and say, I own this, is the same moment when the trees unloose their soft arms from around you, the birds take back their language, the cliffs fissure and collapse, the air moves back from you like a wave and you can't breathe. No, they whisper, you own nothing. You were a visitor, time after time, climbing the hill, planting the flag, proclaiming, we never belonged to you. You never found us. It was always the other way around. There's such an inherent truth in Margaret Atwood's words. And I wanted to read that this morning for our sit, because later on when I give my talk, really being grounded in the truth of things, the way things really are, not the way things we fantasize that they should be, being grounded in the truth of things is so essential for this second fold of the Eightfold Path, right intention. So, Margaret Atwood's poem, I just love it in that it so sets the stage for being grounded in truth. For those of us who are fortunate enough to be parents, we learned that a long time ago. These beings come into the world and then they just come in like themselves and then they grow up and then you go, oh my goodness, who are you? And so that idea that they belong to us, I mean, certainly our hearts are connected, but that's pretty clear. And many ways of grounding ourselves in the truth. And she points out just one of them, that we own nothing and we are visitors. Other truths that we repeat to ourselves often, like all conditioned things arise and fall away. And what is there to be attached to? And certainly the Four Noble Truths. There's dukkha. There's a cause of this suffering. There's a cessation and there's a path. Being grounded in the real world and the truth of the moment, the truth of the way things really are, with that as kind of the backdrop, we delve right into the second of the Eightfold Path, right intention. It flows from right view, where we are based in the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the truth of karma, where all actions of mind, body, and speech have consequences and what we do matters. These first two folds, right view and right intention, are crucial to the entire Eightfold Path, for our entire path of practice. The right intention is the link between right view and how we engage in the world, how we practice the next factors of the Eightfold Path, the moral factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right view and right intention set the direction. As Jerry quoted the famous baseball catcher, Yogi Berra, last week, if you don't know where you're going, you'll end up somewhere else. Well, we need to know where we're going. We're going towards freedom. Freedom from suffering. Freedom from craving. Toward a life of wisdom and compassion. Toward balance and joy. In Nina's talk last week, she raised a number of questions for us to consider about right view. And just as with right view, right intention presents us with questions to pose and reflect upon. What's most important to me in my life? How do I want to live out my life? What are my most valued values? What are most important to me? Many of you have heard me talk about my partner, Bill, who we were together for 35 years. He was a model for me in how you develop a moral compass, how you answer those questions. Unfortunately for him, it started because he had a major mental health crisis when he was about 19 or 20. And he looked at his life and he called, excuse my French, bullshit on everything. So everything fell apart. And then with the help of wonderful therapists and just his determination, he built a life of values. He kept on asking himself over and over, what's most important to me? And when I met him, we dated for about 3 years before I suggested that I move in with him into this crazy warehouse. At the time, it was just filled with stuff, and there was this little room that he lived in. And he invited me over, and I thought I was coming over for kind of a romantic evening. Instead, we sat in these chairs, and he asked me, what's your economic philosophy? What are really those important economic values? Well, I thought of myself as a good person, somebody who, you know, basically tried not to do harm to others and didn't steal or lie or that kind of thing. But I had never even asked myself, what are my economic values? Well, so over the years, I was really influenced by this man who had spent quite a number of years putting that moral compass together. And as I was preparing for this talk, I realized that aligning our intentions with our deepest held values is vitally important. It can also be really challenging to set right intentions. One of the reasons that comes from a Tanissero Bhikkhu article called The Road to Nirvana is Paved with Skillful Intentions. It's a riff on the saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. He says, the road to hell is paved with intentions that are careless, lustful, or mean. He points out how our confusion and misunderstanding and lack of clarity can make setting right intentions really challenging. Another way that setting intentions can be really challenging is that we mix them up, we get mixed up between the difference between intentions and goals. Philip Moffat has some really good words about that. He says that setting intentions is not about outcomes. It's about how you are being in the present moment, in the ever-present now, in the constantly changing flow of life. You set your intentions based on understanding what matters most to you, and you make a commitment to align your worldly actions with your inner values. Another reason why it can be challenging is that we can get so discouraged that we don't always act consistently with our intentions, and we might kind of give up. I recently reread Niall Williams' wonderful book, This Is Happiness, and in it, there's this great quote. He says, "It's one of the tragedies of life that life keeps getting in the way of good intentions." Another reason it's challenging is we think, well, I set my intentions and now they're done. But setting intentions is an ongoing process. It's not a once done and done. It's an ongoing part of living. When we think about our practice, we practice to foster more clarity, greater understanding of our minds. We practice to see clearly. We see clearly our moments of reactivity or meanness in the mind or lustfulness, craving. As with all aspects of our practice, we succeed and fail. We have moments of clarity and moments of confusion. We've learned that, as Philip Moffat says, whatever is manifesting itself in your life right now is affected by how you receive it. And how you receive it is largely determined by your intention in this moment. When we can be grounded in our intentions to do no harm, to be non-reactive, to speak and act from our highest commitments, we pause, reflect, and act as appropriately as we are able in the moment. These highest commitments, which Jerry reminded us of last week, and he often repeats these words from Ajahn Suchito, there's these lovely intentions we practice for our benefit, for the benefit of others, and to cultivate and promote peace. So write intentions like a muscle. You develop it over time by exercising it. When you lose it, you just start over again. And again, Philip Moffat says, right intention is organic. It thrives when cultivated and wilts when neglected. It's simply about coming home to yourself, he says. It's a practice of aligning with the deepest part of yourself while surrendering to the reality that you often get lost in the wanting mind. And you often get lost in the chattery mind, and you often get lost in the confused or deluded mind. It can be challenging, but I know we're all up to the challenge. In the teachings, right intention calls for three specific intentions: the intention of renunciation, the intention of goodwill, and the intention of harmlessness. The intention of renunciation is a remedy to greed. The intention of goodwill is a remedy to aversion. And the intention of harmlessness is a remedy to anger, ill will, resentment, and aggression. So these intentions are a collective remedy to the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. Let's spend a few minutes just digging into these three. The intention of renunciation. We spent a whole month on renunciation last year. We're not monks or nuns, and we aren't renouncing the lives we live. But specifically, renunciation in Buddhism refers to abandoning or relinquishing that which we used to believe would give us lasting happiness, but doesn't. Christina Feldman reminds us not to lean on anything that crumbles. She says, I love this phrase, we try to grasp the ungraspable, preserve the changing, secure the unpredictable, and guarantee the unknowable. Renunciation can be seen as such an act of kindness for ourselves, a step away from suffering and disappointment, a step towards happiness and contentment. Renunciation leads us to a deeper understanding of what Ruth King says, that life is imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal. And it's the heart of our regular practice. We sit down, we relax, we watch sensations and thoughts and sounds come in and out of our consciousness. We know a thought has arisen and we let it go, not getting entangled in it or creating a story about it. A body sensation arises. We note it and let it be. Renunciation, letting go and letting be. It's a moment-to-moment practice. While in the moment, it may not seem like we're doing very much, but in fact, when we're renouncing or letting go of these thoughts and sensations, we're renouncing greed. All those acquisitive, possessive, craving thoughts of wanting more of this, less of that, those thoughts of what we have isn't enough, we aren't enough. Renunciation is a deep acceptance of the moment. This is the way things are right now, and it's okay. The second intention is the intention of goodwill, based in the understanding of the inextricable connection to all beings. And it acts as a remedy to aversion. I don't like this. I want this to go okay. This is not okay being here. I want a different moment, a different reality, a different me. We're not trying to repress thoughts of ill will. Rather, we're practicing the opposite, because repression just buries the thoughts and lets them fester. So what we're practicing is a climate of kindness, a basic friendliness towards whatever and whoever is present. We bring that overarching sense of friendliness to our intentions. The third intention is the intention of harmlessness, also based in the understanding of our connection to all beings, and acts as a remedy to ill will. It is thought guided by compassion and exists as a complement to the friendliness of metta. We recognize the suffering in others just as we recognize our own suffering, and we wish for an end to all the suffering and dis-ease. Back in 2018, I gave a kind of similar talk on right intention, and at the time, it was only 8 months after my partner of 35 years had died suddenly. I shared then, and it's still true, I don't know what I would have done without my practice. People responded to me in some of the most inappropriate ways. But instead of getting angry, I was able to see their own desires and confusions. I didn't like their comments, but I didn't get angry at them. I cultivated an attitude of friendliness, not only to them, but to my own pain. They were acting out of their own confusion and lack of ability to say something useful and kind. I've shared the phrases that I developed back then, which, you know, become my mantra for life. May I trust in the natural unfolding of life, and may I receive that unfolding with ease and understanding. My own process of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness helped me to stop arguing with life. It doesn't work all the time, but oh, the times that they are present, those are really good moments. So just like last month when we explored right view and we asked ourselves, how do we know if we have right view instead of wrong view? Now we ask ourselves the same question about right intention as opposed to wrong intention. We need to look at the results that come from them. We start by looking at the states of our minds. Are we grounded in the way things really are, or are we living in delusion and fantasy? Delusion, as Tanissaro Bhikkhu says, is the primary cognitive defilement. And through our regular meditation practice, we are on the lookout for those moments of delusion. We ask ourselves those hard questions. Am I grounded in what this moment is really like? Am I in denial of the truth? What's the state of my mind? We look once again at the issue of karma. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha said, intention, I tell you, is karma. One does karma by way of body, speech, and intellect, and we see the results of our actions. As we all know, the karma or karma comes from the Sanskrit term that means action. But it's not any divine moral principle. It simply points to the relationship between our intentional actions and their results. It's not about ascribing blame. Norman Fisher points out that the situation you're in is not your fault, but it's absolutely your responsibility to take care of it going forward. The person who did those things in the past is no longer here. The person who is here in this present moment has a huge responsibility to take action from this moment forward. One of the things I learned from a few years ago, we being the teachers and the board and the assistant teachers, the local Dharma leaders, all of us, we spent a couple of years studying Mindfulness of Race, Ruth King's book, and also a year-long study on white privilege. And one of the things I learned had to do with the relationship between intention and result. Regardless of a so-called intention, I, as a white woman, if the resulting language or my behavior is received by a person of color as disrespectful, as belittling or demeaning or reinforcing stereotypes, then the intention was, in fact, not a right one. It grew out of old conditioning, and I have the responsibility to examine my old beliefs and habits and develop deeper understanding so that my behavior in the future is actually aligned with my intentions of doing no harm. The Buddha said that he taught suffering and the end of suffering. In a simple way, right intention asks us to examine our thoughts and actions with a basic question: does this thought or action lead to more suffering, more attachment, more aversion, more ill will, or more confusion? Or does it lead to the end of suffering, kindness, goodwill, peace, clarity, generosity? We keep alert to the quality of our views. If we're holding on to wrong or unkind or deluded views, the outcome will be wrong. Intentions which then give rise to unwholesome or unskillful actions. I've shared a lot in our Sunday sit that I practice at the beginning of every sit with the five recollections. And especially over the last couple of years, I tend to add some adjectives to the third recollection. If you forget what that is, it's I am of the nature to die, and I am not exempt from the truth of this life will end. So the way I say it is, I am the nature to die, and I am not exempt from the truth that this beautiful, amazing, precious life will end, because I will be dead. Right after reciting that, the thought arises, well, then what are my intentions? To live fully this beautiful, amazing, precious life. In the death and dying group that Seattle Insight has, we always ended our gathering with a Zen night chant, which says, may I respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time passes swiftly and opportunities are lost. Let us awaken, awaken. Do not squander your life. So how do I make this chant a reality in my life? And this leads me to the last part of my talk, which is setting intentions for our practice, not only on the cushion, but moment to moment. What does it mean to have an intention to actively practice? First, we want to consistently remember impermanence and the dissatisfaction it causes when we doubt it. We want things to be solid, dependable, and they're not. We want to remember the second noble truth, that we suffer because we cling to things that aren't true and to things which are going to change, but we think or believe that if we cling tightly enough, maybe they'll last and they won't change. That image I have of those tight fists, and I think because death and dying is how I got into the practice, I think about death a lot. I don't want to be this at my deathbed. I want them to be more like that. So that intention to let go of clinging as best we are able, knowing that if we don't loosen our grip, life might force us to let it go, and then it's going to be really painful. We bring calma into our practice. We slow down. Practice is most successful when we pause, when we're not rushing around from one thing to the next. And we remember all the teaching about anatta, about not self. I think a lot about what kind of self is showing up. I describe my little self, the one that is loud and hungry and needy and takes everything personally, as opposed to the big self, who's more mature and generous and remembers my practice and remembers that life is imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal. So we practice practice. That's what Philip Moffat says. And I'll end with a couple comments from him. As you gain insight through meditation, wise reflection, and moral living, your ability to act from your intentions blossoms. It's called a practice because it's an ever-renewing process. You live your intentions every day. Each day, many times, we ask ourselves, am I being true to my deepest intentions? And we make it a living practice. Each time we start over by reconnecting to our intentions, we are taking one more step toward finding our own authenticity and freedom. In that moment, Philip says, you are remembering yourself and grounding your life in your heart's intention. You are living the noble life of the Buddha's teachings. Thank you for your kind attention at this talk on intention. Let's just take a moment of quiet and there were a lot of words. Let those settle. Each of us, as we lead our Sunday sit, we always bring the intention of may our words and reflections be of benefit to everyone who is present. So it's a pretty open discussion. This is the first Sunday on intention, right intention. You all have had a practice for quite a while. I'd be really interested in hearing what are some of your thoughts on the challenges and the gifts of setting your intentions. You can raise your hand or you can just go like this and I'll call on you, and I look forward to whatever you have to share. And please know that Even if you're kind of new to our Sangha, there's such an atmosphere and a commitment of trust. We hold each other's sharings with kindness, with confidentiality, with respect. And we all know too that every time somebody speaks, we learn from it. And it's like, oh, right, that's what I was thinking too. So please feel free to share your thoughts about right intention or anything in your practice. Charlotte, please.
Thank you. I really hesitate to share this because I'm very embarrassed. But it speaks to the phrase that I try to tell myself, how can I help? And I was at the monorail at the Seattle Center on Saturday, and there was three young people who didn't have tickets. And I was grumpy, and I wish I had said, how can I help? And if they had said, I really need tickets, I would have gone over to the ticket thing and bought them tickets. I really regret not helping those children. It pains me. And so that's going to be my mantra for a while, is how can I help myself and others? Thank you.
Charlotte, I so honor your willingness to share that. I've had moments like that where it's afterwards I think, oh, I could have done better. Could have been kinder and more helpful or more connected. And isn't that what our life is step by step? We do the best we are able in the moment. And because we then reflect on it and we feel the pain of it, and then we set a new intention to try to be kinder, more connected, more helpful in the future. Thank you so much for sharing what I think a lot of us have experienced. And it is kind of embarrassing. And it's only inside of us, you know, because we don't always live up to the intentions that we have. Thomas, please.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And thanks a lot for your talk, Sue. It was very, very helpful. A great talk to sort of lay out the map around right intention. And I wanted to share a couple of things. So the first thing is about my own journey with this piece of the Eightfold Path. I must admit, when I came in first, I had a hard time understanding. I saw like right effort, right view, and right intention, how those things work together. And that took me a while. I'm still working with that, sort of just being able to sort of separate them and understand the dynamics between them. I think it's for me, it's probably going to be lifelong work. And I find it very, in the beginning, it was very sort of overwhelming, confusing, and very foreign to me. And then over time, it's become more, more and more inspiring and helpful, but still, I think, puzzling in a really productive way. So my way of working with right intention, I think, first of all, where my mind first goes is sort of like common sense speak around, well, something about being helpful to others, or goodwill, or, you know, just having some good values and sort of putting them towards others and yourself. And that's sort of how I came in. And then after having listened to a number of teachers like you, Suze, and others, understanding that it's sort of the deeper aspect is suffering, is how you work with suffering and reduce suffering for others and yourself. And so my mind still doesn't go there first. It goes more to the sort of common sense. But I then sort of redirect myself and say, this situation here, what's my intention here? Is it really, for example, I had a discussion with a neighbor the other day, and we are politically rich opposite. And I know this can get unpeaceful very fast. Not that we've ever been there, but you know, in that intention, my automatic is sort of like to try to convince. And so I sort of like say, hey, wait a minute, but this is not, the intention is not to convince here. The intention is peace. We're neighbors. We live together. I want this to be peaceful. And that changes my whole approach and is freeing for myself as well. So that would be one example of how it's working for me. So again, thanks a lot for laying it out for us here.
Wow. So much wisdom. Thank you, Thomas. That knowing that trying to convince wasn't going to be easing your own inner world either. And that sense of being right and all that I have. Rodney used to remind me about my self-righteousness for years and years, and he was right. Unfortunately, I used to get mad about it, but it's so easy to go there. Instead of, like, you're setting your intention, I want to have peaceful relations with my neighbor. It's so lovely. And how do I do that? And thank you for that sharing. It's a process. I mean, it's the practice moment by moment. And sometimes, you know, it's like Charlotte was saying, or Thomas too, that you see what comes up in the mind. And you didn't, you know, you're embarrassed. I didn't do what I really wanted to. Or in Thomas's case, he was able to stop that desire to convince. And, you know, isn't that sometimes we're our best selves, and sometimes we're a little bit like 70%, you know? So there it is. If that isn't, you know, then that's a way. So thank you both. I really appreciated the teacher I quoted of that, how right intention is a process. It's not a once and done. It just, we keep on going back. What are my highest values? How do I want to live my life? And how do I connect that with this moment? Anyone else?
Suze, I think Colin has had his hand up.
I'm sorry. Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Candace, and Colin, please go.
Yeah, it's no problem. I'm doing it analog, Sue, so sometimes it's hard, right? And I'm not, like, using emojis. I just want to say thanks. I always think these talks are so rich, and really, if I'm being honest, like, I think about so much through the course of them. But one reason I felt compelled to share today was just what you shared about when your partner died. So it's feels like a unique opportunity to reflect. So my dad died 13 years ago, and he was pretty young. He was like 62, so he wasn't, you know, it was unexpected, as it always is, but maybe a little different in this case, maybe not. But the thing you said about, I had a one-year-old. I lived across the country, and all of a sudden, like, whatever plans I had for that week, I was like back where I grew up, trying to make this part of life, which I had like no playbook for, like, work. So, you know, I can remember at his memorial just some of the things people said, and it hit me in the same way that you described, where a lot of people said, like, this is terrible, we loved your dad, but he's in a better place. And I remember that stinging, like, particularly at the time. And it's just good to hear your experience and be able to reflect that, like, yeah, maybe at the time it was harder to see that, like, you really don't know what to do in those situations. It was, you know, people just trying to deal with it in the same way that I was. And, you know, it's all okay. And so I guess in some ways what it makes me think about is understanding, like, how you try to work with right intention in the context of how other people do, and then making sense of it over time, you know, like going back and reflecting on, you know, ways where it seemed aligned with the path that you're trying to traverse, and maybe at times when it's not so much the case. So I just really appreciated that.
Oh,
thanks.
You're so welcome. There's so many times that I'm confused and I trip over my words and I say something that I think is it's coming from a good place and it's received not in that way at all. And that's a helpful reminder that other people are going through the same thing. And that little easily hurt, fragile little one seems to be so ever present. And, oops, I don't know what just happened. And, forgiving ourselves for what we've done and creating a little bigger space in our minds and hearts. I like when I can take my mind into a really large space and when I see how we're all just trying to navigate this challenging life and we're so fragile and sensitive and tender. And so's everybody else, even the ones who don't appear that way. And so that large mind, large thinking is really helpful for me to kind of bring me back to, oh, right. Yeah. Thanks, Colin. Things that in life that are so hard, and then you look back at them and you learn so much from it. Not that you wanted it to happen, but oh my goodness, there's so many teachings there. Yes, Candace, please go ahead.
One of the things that I love about working with Right Intention is how it just guides the day. I've been working a lot with, you know, just being kind. And it can be so, easy to forget that. And then when it pops back up, because it's becoming a habit, a kind of a mantra, I just cool down my response. And it took me a while to realize that the kindness was also for myself. And to, you know, be kind to me and patient with the times that, oh, I start, you know, complaining about something. And then I think, no, I was going to be kind. You know, how can I do this? And it can be so interesting to just play with something like that in every aspect of your life when you're responding to someone, you're working on a contract and you want to be very clear with them, but how can you just shift it a little bit so that it's kind, the kindest it can be? And I really feel people's attitudes towards me change when I work on that. So it's one of the part of the path that really gives a lot as we work on it. It's just really, very nurturing in a way.
Oh, thank you for that. That is that second intention, the intention of goodwill. And I've always loved Christina Feldman's way of describing metta, which is this overall attitude and presence of friendliness. I, for whatever reason, I have trouble with loving kindness. I don't know what it is about the phrase, but friendliness really, you know, and when you said that you're trying to just be kind, to be friendly to others and then how it then feeds back in. And yeah, I love as people share and all the wisdom that is in our Sunday Sangha and in the larger Sangha. And, you know, there's that line in the Metta Sutta where it says to do nothing that the wise ones would later reprove. And I think about that because, and I think the wise ones, my teachers and our guiding teachers at Sims, but also I think about all of you folks, you know, the wise ones that gather on Sundays and Monday nights and Thursdays and Tuesday and Thursday mornings. And all my Dharma buddies are the wise ones. And it kind of keeps me on the straight and narrow to some extent. It, you know, I go, really, is this what I want to be doing? It's another one of those values that, I don't want the wise ones to later reprove because I was acting reactively or unkindly or thoughtlessly. Yeah. Anyone else? We have some few more minutes before announcements and closing. Really appreciate ourselves for our commitment to practice, our commitment to the Dharma, to the sitting with the truth of the way things are, our commitments to our intentions to do no harm and to be kind, to be generous, to be thoughtful, to slow down our lives, to simplify. These are such beautiful practices that we all do. And the world really needs us. I don't know if you all think about that, but I do a lot, that the way that many of you have shared this morning of wanting to promote peace, wanting to be generous and helpful, wanting to spread kindness, all of that is really useful, beneficial, healing, nurturing to our world. May the merit of all of our practices be shared with all beings everywhere, near and far, to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, above and below. May all beings benefit from the sincerity and commitment and intentions of our practice. May all beings be free from suffering. Be well. Feel free to unmute and say goodbye. It's been lovely sitting with you all. Enjoy your Sunday. Have a great week. See you all soon.